This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Now, when we see a doctor, we share a story of sorts, starting with our description of the symptoms to our doctor. This is the problem I've been having, followed by the doctor's delivery of a diagnosis. This is what you have, and probably prescription of some sort of therapy. This is what you need to do. But patient care may not necessarily depend on this linear narrative that you hear on the surface alone. Doctors seek to explore a deeper understanding of their patients' suffering, informed by their own relationships and experiences. Do healthcare providers today have the time or the skills, however, to explore the nuances and contexts of their patients' stories and situations amid what seems like a highly transactional environment of healthcare? I'm wondering how narrative-based medicine can help healthcare professionals better understand their patients' stories and experiences. And I have joining me on the show today via Zoom somebody who I think will be the best person to explain this concept of narrative-based medicine. That's Dr. Catherine Rogers, Associate Director and Lecturer with the Division of Narrative Medicine in Columbia University, all the way from New York in the US. And also a local perspective, Dr. Chong Li Ai, Senior Lecturer at the Pain and Palliative Care Unit with the Department of Pediatrics, University of Malaya. Dr. Catherine and Dr. Chong, thank you so much for bearing with that long introduction. How are the both of you today?
Thanks for having us, Xiaoyik. We're good.
Thank you so much, Xiaoyik. It's a pleasure to be here with you. We're very well here in New York, where it's 1 degree.
Glad you're indoors then.
We're indoors where it's more like 24, 25. So
perfect then, yes.
Yeah, and I also would like to begin by thanking the Fulbright Foundation and the Malaysian American Commission on Educational Exchange, who were behind this collaboration between Columbia University Narrative Medicine and University Malaya Faculty of Medicine here this year.
Which I'll be finding out about a little bit later on. But I wanted to dive into this idea of stories. And I know narrative-based medicine is probably, you're going to tell me that it's more than just stories, but that idea of a story in our health seeking, would either of you want to share a story with me that would illustrate how it puts a person in healthcare? Either Li Ai from the perspective of a clinician or Catherine, just your perspective.
Well, I guess as a pediatrician, we love stories. You know, we are witness to the creativity and imagination of children. So we love to tell children stories. And so stories have a part in our lives. But as a clinician in medicine, you know, in the clinical years, like you mentioned earlier, the training of a doctor, you know, you are taught to take a thorough history. We keep telling our students that, take a thorough history. And it is the story from a patient or a parent that they bring to the healthcare space that is crucial to the discovery of what is wrong with them, what is their diagnosis, what is their illness, and how we would go about managing. So it is how we take the story that will be the start of our relationship and bond with them. So I could share a story. Recently, we had a mom who wasn't really keen to take a certain medication that was recommended. Her child had taken a couple of doses, and then mom says, you know, was adamant that no, he should not continue. So it's easy to assume that, you know, she is of a poorer social economic group. She wasn't well educated. You know, she just didn't understand what was going on. But if you listen attentively to her story and pay attention and be curious, there are layers in her story that led her to that
decision,
you know, of not continuing. So I think that's where a good clinician is. We need to pay attention to these stories. You know, she, her child had been quite ill several years before, so she has seen him, you know, go through a lot. And now he is, you know, back down again. And so she didn't want him to suffer anymore. She didn't want him to go through any more side effects. And she had given her life up, you know, her job, just to take care of this child. So from her point of view, it's important he lives well and not have any side effects. And also her personal life, she didn't have a lot of support. She was all by her own, and all this was just all coming back. This illness was coming back, really overwhelming and causing a lot of chaos. So I think if we delve deeper and be more curious, there is a lot in the story to uncover, you know, just that will explain where she's coming from her point of view. I think that's what we're trying to teach medical students, I think, to pay attention. Yeah.
Yeah. Catherine, do you have a story you'd like to share?
Yes, I'm really struck by what Dr. Chong Liai is saying about listening to the personal life of that patient and realizing the patient was all by herself, which may be a stress, and adding that into the thoughts about how to treat the mother's child, the patient. You know, as an artist, as a playwright, you know, I grew up creating stories and imagining people, creating whole lives around these people. And so at Columbia University, in the first year of medical school, in addition to taking all of those required science courses like anatomy and physiology, biochemistry, et cetera, the students are required to take one unit of narrative medicine, which means for me that I teach a class in playwriting to a group of medical students. And during the semester, each of these students writes a short play and we actually perform it for the public. They write and perform in each other's plays. Well, as you know, I'm not a doctor, so I leave it up to them at the end of the class. I say, can you let me know, what does playwriting have to do with medicine? And they say, one of my students said, well, you know, I had to create this character and I had to imagine everything about them and what motivated them. And I also had to imagine their whole world and all the elements of the world and write that down. And he said, I hope that that's what I'm going to do when a patient walks into my office, is to really use those same skills to learn about and imagine what their world is like and who they really are. And I think the story that Dr. Chong Liai just told us, it reflects exactly what my student said he was learning by writing plays.
But increasingly, Liai, and I guess this is just the nature of the healthcare system, our society as well. Doctors, healthcare providers all say we're strapped for time. You know, we want to take a thorough history, but at the end of the day, we need to treat their symptoms, their problems, and then see the next patient and the next, right? Do you think that central role of the patient's stories has taken a backseat?
Yeah, I think the training has moved towards focusing on the diagnosis, the pathology, finding the cause of the illness, and really spending a lot of time and effort in that we've lost the person in it. But time is an essence, you know, you have only a few minutes in your clinic. So I think the training that you get in narrative medicine and being competent in those skills with practice, you can then, it's incorporated and you get to use it better. So it may take time, but if you're very skillful with practice, I think you could really delve into their stories very quickly. So I think it's just training and being competent with practice. I think it's possible because it's if you have a doctor who's attentive, who are able to pick up issues more skillfully and quickly, you'll be able to deal with it sooner. You won't have the patients coming over and over again because the doctor has not listened. So it will be time saving, you know, at the end of the day.
And Catherine, there is actual value in listening to and understanding the narratives when we look at health outcomes, right? Because it's not just about making the patients and their caregivers feel good, quote unquote. You will see better care and better quality of life, right? Is there anything that you'd like to add here to illustrate that?
Yes, you know, better relationships makes better care and better medicine. And also, we are talking about the relationship between patient and doctor, but they're also the relationship among the doctors themselves now, the way medicine works now, that it's very team-based. And there's also the relationship of the physician and the healthcare provider with themselves, knowing themselves better, knowing their own biases, also keeping themselves healthy. You know, the physician, you know, one of the outcomes that we measured, which makes for better medicine, better relationships, is having healthier physicians and healthcare workers, because they are so at high risk for burnout, and suicide rates among healthcare workers and physicians are increasing. The pressures of contemporary medicine are so high. Plus, you know, we do not always think about, yes, the patient comes in and the patient is ill. Illness is unexpected. The patient is suffering, facing death. But the physician is similarly suffering alongside of that patient. Every patient who comes in with a surprise. And it's not always a welcome surprise. It's a surprise of illness. Every patient who comes in is requiring the physician and the healthcare worker to confront their own mortality and death. And this happens, you know, 12 minutes after 12 minutes after 12 minutes all day long with a patient. And that kind of stress on our healthcare workers is really, it's really important to relieve that stress in the name of better medicine. And we have measured some outcomes, both at medical student level. We have a research where medical students were working with pieces of art and learning to really look carefully and deeply at pieces of art. And it did increase their observational skills that doctors need when patients walk in. What am I seeing? But it also increased their sense of self-care, using these narrative medicine methods that we've developed over the years at Columbia. And there are other studies in progress and studies that have been done to show how these narrative medicine techniques have helped with healthcare work and medical workers' wellness, and have helped to mitigate burnout among healthcare and medical workers. Hmm. So yeah, there are some real practical outcomes.
We'll go for a quick break and continue this conversation. I'm speaking to Dr. Catherine Rogers, Associate Director and Lecturer with the Division of Narrative Medicine in Columbia University in the US, and Dr. Chong Li Ai, Senior Lecturer with the Pain and Palliative Care Unit in University of Malaya's Department of Pediatrics. We're discussing narrative-based medicine and how narratives in medicine improve care. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Joining me on the show today via Zoom, Dr. Chong Li Ai, a senior lecturer with the Pain and Palliative Care Unit at University of Malaya's Department of Pediatrics, and all the way from New York in the United States, Dr. Catherine Rogers, Associate Director and Lecturer with the Division of Narrative Medicine in Columbia University. We've been discussing the concept of narrative-based medicine, starting with the idea and practical illustrations of how understanding, listening to, taking the time to get to know your patient's narratives, their stories, their experiences, their life circumstances, matter, why that matters in healthcare. From the patient and consumer's perspective, do you think that there is a barrier now, Li Ai, perhaps you would like to weigh in here, in trusting healthcare providers enough to share their stories. Increasingly, we do see more distrust in the quote-unquote authority of science and medicine. And I think that flared up a lot during the pandemic as well. What do you think has led to that divide between healthcare providers and patients? And can we bridge that with healthcare providers who are trained in narrative medicine?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. When we provide healthcare, we expect to build rapport with our patients. You have a trusting relationship. And only with a trusting relationship, like you said, they will share their stories so that we can have our medical input, come together and see what's best for this patient. So if they do not trust us, then it's really hard for us to provide good medical care. So I think doctors, you know, within the training needs to re-emphasize that medicine is a healing profession. You're trying to make people feel better. The humanistic side to medicine is slowly deteriorating because with technological advancement, we are more focused on what we can do to fix things, to look for diagnosis, to focus on pathology. And then we've forgotten the human side of us, you know, to be empathetic, to listen, to pay attention to the patient sitting in front of us or their parents, the interaction between the child and the parents or the patient and their adult children. So it is the human side of things. I think medicine is really a human side of art. So if you have an empathetic healthcare professional, they're more likely to be able to, you know, a patient is more likely to be able to trust you and to share. So I think that's where we should be aiming for. So narrative medicine does kind of try to train with its specific methodology to train a doctor to be more attentive, to be able to, you know, listen more carefully, to take risk and be comfortable with uncertainty, ambiguity, because that comes up often. You know, you never really know whether it works, and to be comfortable with that, then you can really sit with the patient and be side by side along to look for a solution that is patient-centered, that is right for this patient, rather than to say, you know, they have a certain disease and this is the standard management for that disease. So it should be the person who has this disease, what is right for this patient, rather than treating the disease, let's treat the patient.
I guess, you know, concept aside, what might narratives in healthcare actually look like in a practical daily setting that we can all relate to? I think, Leah, you did share a great example of a mother and her child. Catherine, are there any other examples that you might want to share from your side of the world as well? Different cultures, perhaps a different context.
The thing about narrative medicine is that we're operating from the understanding that the human being is a narrative creature. Like every human being is a story. We are a story. Narrative or stories are the way we make sense of everything that happens to us, make sense of who we are, make sense of this illness that I have, and make sense of something that's in my family. That narrative and story is really at the basis of what the human being is. So when we say narrative medicine, we're sort of restoring that part of medicine that was part of, you know, early medicine. It was always part of medicine and sort of got disconnected from medicine, as Leah was talking about, when, you know, the corporatization of medicine, as it becomes stronger and stronger, gets disconnected from medicine when medical education concentrates only on the biomedical and not on the whole person or the whole story or the whole family or the whole society. So that's not an anecdote or an example. I'm not in a clinic. I don't have those anecdotes. But what I do have is this this understanding that those of us, like the playwrights, the literary scholars, the philosophers, the humanities professors, the social justice workers, that all of us dwell in story. We spend every day working with story, how stories are told, how to really look deeply into stories, you know, so that, for example, when we read a poem, we take every single word and every single word has a meaning, and we're piecing together sort of a diagnosis of this poem by looking at every single word there. That kind of skill that a literary scholar or a poet has is the same kind of skill that a doctor needs. And so narrative medicine and the way that we practice it, we're hoping by bringing these humanities experts into medical school and into the clinic to work with doctors, we're hoping to help restore that side of medicine, of really being able to listen to and understand stories, really using the skills that literary scholars have been using for years and years, using those skills in the clinic to help really look at the meaning of this transaction that's going on between a patient and a physician.
Lee, fundamentally, do you think that it will require a huge paradigm shift for healthcare providers to accept the role, the very fundamental, actually very human part of us to come out in healthcare, right? Because you're trained, like you said, in looking at pathology, you're trained to make decisions based on evidence. In your experience talking about this and exploring this, is there resistance from healthcare providers?
Yeah, it's surprisingly no. So we ran a workshop with Catherine and another faculty from Columbia. So we had almost 3/4 of the group from medicine and then 1/4 from arts and humanities. And it was quite surprising that the people in medicine really liked the workshop, really liked this work where, you know, it delved into reaching out deep into their artistic side of things and really looking like what the methodology is, like close reading, close looking, and really understanding how it all comes to play and how it's really similar to what they do. And seeing changing the mindset of, yeah, you know, you can actually look at a piece of work and bring out that attentiveness in yourself and then bring it into the clinical sphere where you actually do pay attention, hone in on those skills again that have not been quite emphasized in medical school. So I think the mindset change or this leap is not huge. It just needs bringing it into their consciousness, I think, that the intersection of arts and humanities and clinical work is really similar. The skills that are used, we can use those skills.
We polled these participants afterward, one of the questions we asked is whether these practices that we had used in this workshop, whether these narrative medicine practices would change their medical practice in any way. And 100% of the participants said either it would very likely or likely change their practice. They mentioned things like listening more deeply to their patients. So that 100% of people said they were positively affected by these narrative medicine techniques.
Lee, have you heard back from them since they actually went back into practice? I'm wondering how it does play out when they're in that clinic with 100 other patients waiting outside, right? And that's when you see whether you can put that into action or not.
Yeah, I mean, this workshop was in January, so I haven't gone back to them. But, I mean, the feedback they gave was quite positive. You know, they would say, you know, now I will really give more time to my patients to talk rather than interrupting them. You know, I will listen to the patients more, put myself in their shoes. You know, they talked about, you know, actually also about themselves, how they were rejuvenated. You know, they felt refreshed that, you know, they could understand themselves better. There was a lot of self-discovery too. So once you, I think once you know, you learn more about yourself, you are able to represent yourself better in the relationship with patients. So, but yeah, it's something we will consider, giving them some time to practice, and then we could go back to them and redo the survey to say, did it make a difference to your actual practice? Because it's something new, and it's a new perspective that is meaningful. I think they see the meaning in this, the, being more attentive, this relationship with that you can build with a patient. It makes a difference.
Yeah, here in the stateside, we see it because it's not just a one-time workshop that, for example, I give a monthly narrative medicine session at one of the major hospitals here in New York City. And so we have a group who comes once a month, and we just do very simple narrative medicine exercise with them once a month. And they report, of course, that they feel better, they're refreshed each week, each time they come. But also we did a play with one of them, one of the groups. One time we brought a play and they acted out the play. And at the end of it, one of the physicians said, "Oh, I understand a lot better now what it means when I deliver bad news to my patients, because having to play the role doing this play with you, I understand that it's similar to assuming the role as the physician who cares about this patient, who cares about the bad news. I have a script I have to deliver, but I realize now that it's really me, and I really do care, even though I'm saying these words that I'm told to say." So there are many other examples like that, where physicians who come once a week, but once a month to narrative medicine, that it really does affect their practice, and they are able to sustain some of these some of the benefits that they receive.
You know, we used to hear, as a healthcare provider, don't get too attached, don't get too emotionally attached to your patients. Does this certain sort of like counter that?
Yes, you know, medical education would tend to dwell on just the science, the hard, cold science, the hard, cold evidence of science, and step away. Yes, don't involve yourself in the emotions. Well, the doctor also is a human being. The doctor also is facing death. The doctor also has either experienced illness or will experience it. It's a little unrealistic to say don't get emotionally involved, because the doctor's a person, not a robot. So narrative medicine helps to provide the physician with ways of being human and yet still protecting themselves, still having boundaries between themselves and the patient.
Liai, what do you think? I'd like to hear your thoughts as well, because I think in palliative care, it is probably, without a doubt, that one specialty where physicians, the best way for you to practice your specialty is to listen, to get emotionally attached, right? But do you think that can be sort of replicated to convince, you know, your fraternity that to get emotionally attached doesn't take away the science that you can practice?
Yeah, I think with a relationship with a patient, especially if you've got chronic illness, you have a long relationship. You almost get to know them really, really well. And that helps with helping them through this journey. So knowing them well, knowing what's important to them, helps you. So automatically you will get kind of bonded with them. But I think it's in our training too, that you need to know where to draw the line. Doesn't mean that you get, you know, you don't get sucked in and you can't step out. So there are ways to ensure that you don't get drawn in and you can't step out, because like you said, you know, we'll be seeing many patients, and if you carry each patient along each time, then you really get fatigue. So I think we need to find ways to cope, to realize that we are taking on more than we can. And so be mindful. I think that's important, to be mindful when we are tired or we are kind of taking on more than we can. Realizing the signs that we demonstrate, it means we are tired, and knowing when to step back. And it's a team, so let somebody else do it. You know, you're not indispensable. Yeah. There are many in the team. And also the team makes you strong. So we have ways to ensure the team is remains strong. We have exercises that we do together as a team so that we can separate work and personal life. Yeah. So there is mindful practice in there to ensure that we don't get burnt out.
I think this notion of the team is really important. What Leah is bringing up is it's not only the physician setting boundaries with the emotional relationship with the patient, but in narrative medicine, when a team sits around a table and all together they look at a poem and each person on the team says, oh, this is what I see in that poem, or this is what I see, what happens in the conversation is that the team is communicating with each other in ways that they don't during the day when they say, yeah, blood pressure was 130 over. And they're communicating on a deeper and human level and in an emotional level just for that hour of sitting around the table doing a narrative medicine practice. And teams report that they get to know each other better. That way they get to know each other as people, which is really sustaining and really does help with burnout and with, you know, the emotional intensity of what they have to do. I was working at a major hospital here in New York, and we had an hour and a half narrative medicine session with this group of residents, and their director was there as well. And this particular hospital was having an issue with teamwork, and they brought in narrative medicine to help build teamwork. And so in this day, they did a play together, and they all assumed the roles of this play. It was the Trojan women, and one of the doctors was the god, and the chief resident was the queen. And they worked together on this, assuming the roles. And at the end of it, their director said, well, that's the best teamwork I've ever seen this group do. And so that was just an hour and a half. So these practices that we've developed over the 20-some years in narrative medicine really do have effect on the emotional well-being.
Actually, do you feel like the hierarchy within the profession falls away as well?
This is what I noticed on that very same team, because it was mostly residents. But then, and the director was there, and then they also invited in some medical students. And when we did a survey at the end, they responded, yes, Shawik, they responded, it helped me to see things from the other perspectives. Like the medical students understood why the residents might get a little impatient. The residents understood where the medical students were coming from. And the director observed her group that she was so concerned about in a whole other light. So it that's only one example. We've had some research too, where we had some research in 2019. Dr. Gowda, who was the other clinician, narrative medicine professional who did our January workshop here in Malaysia. Dr. Gowda did some research in 2019 with an interprofessional group in a hospital where you had everyone from the receptionist to the chief around the table doing narrative medicine. And they measured, and they did measure that it, those narrative medicine sessions, which were only 30 minutes long in Dr. Gowda's study, once a month, those narrative medicine sessions did soften clinical hierarchies, they said in their qualitative research.
That's brilliant.
I think it also that study also showed that interprofessional communication improved. I think if you take yourself or your team out of the healthcare setting, then it just allows that self growth and that interprofessional communication to just fall apart. That the hierarchy just falls apart, and the way the narrative medicine work is run, everyone sits around the table, nobody is more superior than other. It just kind of inculcates that practice, and if you do it long enough, you know, you just become naturally adopt those techniques. Yeah.
So just very quickly, it's, you do things like plays, artworks, poetry, is that right, Catherine?
Yes. One of the things that over the years that we have developed in narrative medicine is this signature method, which is simply a group of clinicians or mixed group. A group sits around a table in a non-hierarchical way, and we all put our heads together over a text instead of over a person. You know, a text is really safe. No one, the poem is not going to die if we get it wrong. And so we'll all look at the same poem together, or we'll all act out roles in a play, or we'll look at a painting by Rothko, or we'll look at we'll listen to a piece of music together, just some kind of text where we're all looking at it together, and each of us then is bringing our individual responses. We're each bringing individually what we see, our observations, and then we begin to also speak about our feelings toward it, or our reactions to what's happening in this poem or in this play or in this this page from a novel. And what happens then is that we begin to understand that, you know, listen, I'm a professional in theater and drama, and I have a degree in English, and I learned how to analyze all kinds of literature. But when I sit around a table with a physician and I look at a poem and they say, you know, it seems like this person might be suffering from, and then they name some disease, that's something I never in 200 years would see in that poem, you know. You know, and then when I say, well, you know, the metaphor of going over the sea, and the physician says, oh, yeah, metaphor, I remember that from undergrad, and I haven't thought about that in a long time. So we're sharing different ways of looking at exactly the same thing. And that's what a medical team does when they're doing the study, you know, when they're doing rounds on a patient. You know, they're all seeing something a little different. And then we're learning that actually that's good. You know, I call it evidence-based poetry. We talk so much about evidence in medicine. And when we say evidence, what we mean is the biological evidence, the things that we measured, like what we saw in the blood test. But, you know, when that patient walks in the door, everything they say is evidence. And when we're sitting around a table looking at a piece of art or looking at a poem, and we're looking for at every single word in that poem is evidence for the meaning or meanings of the poem. Similar with the patient, that why, as Leah was saying very early on, you know, when that little kid comes in with mom and mom is like, oh, and then, you know, I'm a single mother and I have to blah, blah. That is part of the evidence of how to treat this child. So it's just a very simple method. It can take half an hour and a half of a small group looking at artwork, saying what they see. And then we also do some writing, because expressing yourself in writing brings so many things to the surface that beyond what we do when we express ourselves just by talking. And then the sharing together does what Leah was talking about earlier, building trust among the team around that table.
Such a good reminder, right? That a patient doesn't walk in the door as a vial of blood or an X-ray. Yeah, right. they walk in as a person, right? Leah, I'm curious, when you were presented your first poem, or I'm not sure what was done in the workshop in Malaysia, but did you find it difficult?
I attended the workshop in Columbia, New York. That was my first workshop, and I was like really daunting because I can't write. I'm not artistic at all. And I was like, oh no, you know, I have to look at the poem. I haven't even read a poem in ages. So it was quite scary initially. But because of how it's run, that it, you know, it there was it was very comfortable. So we looked at the poems, like, oh, okay, is this how we do it? And I was surprised how, like, you know, just opening your mind and your heart to actually trying to look at it without judgment. You know, nobody's judging me. You know, nobody says, oh, you're from Malaysia. You know, it was just very neutral. And like, okay, let's try it, because I don't know anybody here. It doesn't matter. If I make a fool of myself, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, I could see that everyone was just so, yeah, let's look at it and say whatever we feel and then just be open about it. And so you could see the different perspective. It's like, oh, I didn't think of that before, you know, like how did she come about with that? It's like, yeah, that really makes sense. So I think it's just seeing different perspectives and kind of like, oh yeah, you know, it helps me kind of be more open. It's like to different points of view. And then when you had to write, it's like, oh, I can't write. You know, all we do here is type, right? And we put point form. You've never written a full sentence. But it's just this practice that comes on, and seeing others do it kind of encourages you too. So
to wrap up, can I get each of you to share where would you like to see Malaysia go with this? What can we do next to develop this further? Li'ai first?
Yeah, I think I have small vision, so let's work with UM. You know, you can't think too big and it's too hard to accomplish. So small little steps, I think it's useful. So perhaps the training of medical students in UM or our postgraduate trainings. So the medical curriculum in UM it's rather packed. It's a really busy 5-year schedule. So perhaps we could introduce elements of narrative medicine in the existing programs that they have, kind of just refining how things are done with small groups of medical students. And maybe we're thinking maybe in the orientation of the whole group of medical students, that's where they have a little bit more time. And when they're coming into medical school for the first time, and let's make them realize that the intersection of science and humanities is actually part and parcel of the training of a good doctor. It's not, you know, an elective or a distraction, you know, in the busy pursuit of this scientific knowledge. You know, it is actually part and parcel of your training. So we hope that we can maybe in the orientation of medical students get our arts and humanities collaborators come in together with us and kind of show these medical students that's what training should be. So hopefully we can bring that in and then maybe do some of these little group work in our postgraduate training with our pediatric department to start off with.
And Catherine?
Yes, I think what Leah was pointing out about coming to New York to our workshops, those workshops are, and feeling comfortable, those workshops are run by really highly trained facilitators who have master's degrees in narrative medicine and so on. And so one hope is that more people from Malaysia will come to that kind of workshop and get immersed in it. And another hope is that the exchange can continue. Fulbright Foundation has been enormously generous in supporting this initial exchange. And they have Fulbright has other programs and perhaps or other exchange possibilities so that people can come from Malaysia to New York and from Columbia Narrative Medicine to Malaysia to assist with this development. And I think that Leah is exactly right in saying that one place to begin is that first day of medical school when the students come in for orientation is to incorporate narrative medicine immediately as part of good medicine, not just something nice that we add on to feel better, but it's a really essential part of narrative medicine. And I hope that the exchange will continue.
Hmm. Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing all of your thoughts with me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Catherine Rogers, Associate Director and Lecturer with the Division of Narrative Medicine in Columbia University in New York, and Dr. Chong Lee Ai, Senior Lecturer in the Pain and Palliative Care Unit in University of Malaya's Department of Pediatrics. This has been Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.